Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Josh Lerner from Harvard Business School. Josh and I met at the annual conference of the Toulouse Network on Information Technology, which was held in Washington, D.C. in September 2012. We spoke about his new book, The Architecture of Innovation.
I think we all agree that innovation is something that's really important right now. I think, you know, certainly in both the U.S. and Europe, we have this tremendous appetite for growth and need for growth to get us out of the economic doldrums that we're in. Certainly when you look at the historical record, growth and success of countries, particularly developed countries and growing, has been very much linked to their capabilities of innovation. And I think we see that policymakers around the world have, you know, very much cottoned on to this and are very much pushing for more innovation. But innovation is more than just simply getting more inputs, more R&D spending, or more researchers. How the innovation is organized is absolutely critical in terms of affecting how successful it's going to be. What I do here is really very much look at the two models by which innovation has been largely organized over the last half century: the traditional large corporate research laboratory and the more focused new venture, you know, pursuing an individual idea. And what I argue is that while both models are extremely powerful and certainly have had a lot of successes, at the same time, they've also have some very real limitations and are both under a lot of pressures today as well.
You use the subtitle of your book, The Economics of Creative Organizations, and I guess in a way you're looking at two different types. You're looking at the big operations, the corporate venturers, the bit that spend on big labs, the historically places like Bell Labs, and then you're looking at the small operations, perhaps supported by venture capitalists. Can you give us a bit more of a feel for that ecosystem?
I think if you think about the kind of trade-offs that are involved, large companies clearly have a kind of staying power and a long time horizon, and they also can put a lot of resources to work and bring together a mix of skills and backgrounds. But at the same time, it's clear that many of the corporate R&D facilities, however creative they've been, when it comes to the process of translating those discoveries into products, doesn't work. And whether it's organizational issues, whether it's poor incentives, whether it's a lack of urgency, there's been very real challenges. On the startup side, clearly there's been amazing successes. It's also true that it's been very limited geographically to, you know, essentially Silicon Valley and a few other areas around the world. It's also been very limited in terms of the aggregate success to areas in information technology and software, and even within that to a relatively small bands of technology. And it's also been very limited in terms of the time periods where it's been successful. So while venture capital clearly has, or a venture-backed startup has a lot of power, it doesn't seem to be a one-size-fits-all solution, and instead it actually seems to be quite limited. What I argue here is that there is a real potential in terms of taking the best of both worlds, of taking features from the corporate model and from the new venture model and combining them in a way which really gives the strengths of both.
And how do we do that? How do we encourage that? How do we get the incentives right to for these different kinds of organization to really get the innovation going again?
I think there's a number of things. There's clearly some things on the public policy side we can point to. And I think that, you know, you can think about some of the issues around just simply the difficulty of contracting. And we can point to things like intellectual property, which is clearly a key asset in terms of these arrangements, and what the state of disarray is in terms of intellectual property. Clearly also doing stuff that's entrepreneur friendly will mean that there are more startup companies and more people willing to make the plunge and hopefully then to collaborate in a variety of different ways. But I think there's also need for real changes in terms of both the way that venture firms and corporations work. I think that when you look at, for instance, some of the difficulties that venture capitalists have faced in areas like biotech and clean tech, a lot of the problems has been that there's been this structure of 8 to 10 year funds. Why has it been like that? Well, largely because the oil and gas contracts that they based the first venture funds, venture partnerships off of, were 8 to 10 years, and they basically just carried over that structure. And it's not at all clear that it makes sense in this area. Similarly, we can look at the corporate efforts that have been done in the space of corporate venturing, and we often see that, you know, they've been very fickle and often had an unwillingness to make commitments, and that there's a whole variety of things we can think of ways corporations could tie their hands or essentially give more staying power to the efforts. So I think there are a variety of areas, from both stuff which is on the public policy side and stuff that private sector can do, that can make these kinds of middle ground, this mix between corporate and new venture models more effective.
Let's look at the particular area of intellectual property that you mentioned and a particular sector which I know you've thought about, which is cloud computing. The European Commission recently has said how important they think that will be to the future of the European economy. But your research findings suggest that public policy is actually moving in the wrong direction there.
Well, certainly within Europe, it's a very interesting contrast. In the United States, there was a decision in 2008, which is known as the Cablevision decision, which essentially gave quite clear rights for individual consumers to basically have a right to take copyrighted intellectual property and put it up in the cloud. You know, in this case, it was essentially a virtual DVR recorder, but we can also think that it has implications for people sharing music and many other kinds of applications and using cloud-based areas. When you look at the similar litigation that proceeded in both France and in Germany, you see that if anything, it moved in the other direction, that the decision seemed to narrow the rights of individuals to be able to use their intellectual property as they saw fit, and if anything, you know, strengthen the hand of the owners of the copyrights. And I think more generally, there's been a series of legislation at the EU level as well, which certainly has restricted the dissemination and the eagerness with which cloud-based technologies have been embraced. Certainly, when you look at the experience in the US, you see that that decision, which essentially made it easier for individuals to use and store stuff in the cloud, seems to have had a very positive effect, controlling for everything you can think of, on the willingness of venture capitalists to fund new ventures. And meanwhile, if you look within Europe, the countries which basically made decisions that were unfriendly to cloud storage saw a pulling back in the relative amount of venture investment taking place there. So on the one hand, we hear this rhetoric from the European community, but if you look at the actual actions that have been taken and what the likely implications are, it seems likely to very much discourage private investment in these areas.
Another area of rhetoric, perhaps by policymakers, is surrounding the importance of public funding of science and then pushing on from that into innovations. How do you see universities and other institutions of research fitting into the innovation ecosystem you described?
Well, I think that clearly universities and publicly funded research have an important role to play. But I think one of the misconceptions that often policymakers labor under is the sense that it's something that's dubbed the pipeline model, that if you just shove stuff in the beginning in basic research, all these wonderful commercial stuff will come out the other end. And I think one of the things that we've seen very clearly is that it's a much more complicated process, and that in particular, the rules and the capabilities that are in the hands of universities regarding commercialization has a huge impact on it. I think there's probably no clearer example of this than the experience of the UK university system, where clearly a variety of really fabulous technologies have been developed, but which sadly for Britain have been in many cases commercialized in the United States.
And how does the patent system fit into this? Because there's issues, aren't there, around people pursuing patents which make sort of micro increments in a technology, but perhaps forgetting the big picture where you might do some blue sky thinking. You think we could really come up with a fabulous new idea that could really push things forward.
Right. So economists traditionally view patents as a necessary evil. You don't like monopolies. We don't like monopolies. We don't want to give up monopolies, but we're willing to do so to encourage innovation. In a lot of ways, when you look at the system in the US today, and sadly, increasingly in Europe, though not nearly to the same extent, we're seeing this disconnect between the patents that are issuing and the innovations that are being done. I think it's clearly most dramatic in areas like software and business methods, but this is a much broader systemic problem. So in a way, we've ended up with what really looks like the worst of all possible worlds, in the sense that we're essentially giving away these monopolies, but essentially not to the guys who are doing the original innovating, and as a result, encouraging patent gamesmanship, but not necessarily encouraging innovation.
There's a kind of feeling around certain circles at the moment. I think thinking perhaps of the stagnationist work of people like Robert Gordon and Tyler Cohen, suggesting that, you know, perhaps there aren't going to be any great innovations. Where do you stand on that kind of view of innovation?
Highly skeptical. And, you know, we obviously can go back in time. You know, Nate Rosenberg has this great paper where he sort of looks at all these inventions that was made and highlighted that even the inventors didn't really see at all what the potential for these things were. Tom Watson saying the total demand for computers would be 7 or something along these lines. And furthermore, we can see many, many cases where very bright people have predicted an end to innovation. You know, for instance, the head of the British Patent Office in the 1900s saying that basically everything that could be invented had been. With the benefit of hindsight, it seems that there's a human tendency to say all the great stuff is behind us. But in many cases, it seems that those kind of predictions have been a little premature.
Josh, we've been talking about business strategy and public policy primarily in the United States and Europe. How do you see this fitting with the rise of Asia and the other BRIC economies mm-hmm. in terms of their ability to innovate and the ability of us in Europe and the United States to innovate?
Yeah, well, I mean, these are extremely interesting questions, but one thing that is clear is that there is a tremendous amount of attention to these issues in almost all the BRIC and the BRIC plus countries that you see. In some cases, places, for instance, like Russia, there's a real awareness that the economy is dependent, you know, to an extent it's probably undesirable in the long run on natural resources and the need to do substitution. In other places, and I think China would be a good example of this, there's a sense that there's a real need to sort of generate continued employment and also a sense that the global changing dynamics are meaning that the existing paradigms that have been so successful for quite a while are unlikely to be so. In these places, you're seeing, and many others, you're seeing government spending an increasing amount of time thinking very carefully about innovation and how to encourage both the beginning of the process in terms of quality universities and the like, but also how to do the back end in terms of encouraging venture activity, in terms of encouraging the commercialization of discoveries from universities and the like.
Josh Leonard, thank you very much.
My pleasure.